Begin in a moment with Exodus 2:15. Exodus begins with the death of Joseph. He travels through their time in Mount Sinai. Why did they come to Egypt? There was a famine. They came to Egypt with the assistance and the providence of Joseph. And in that coming, they resided and began to live in a fertile area of Egypt. And in that area, they prospered. But then something happened. And there was a change in the leadership in Egypt, which was quite different from the leadership where Joseph came. And what happened to him then? What was happening to him then? Labor was hard on them. This nation had moved into that delta area of the Egyptian country, I guess. And in that area, they prospered, but their population was growing and growing and growing, no doubt with God's help. And that new leadership in Egypt began to oppress them, began to overwork them, more or less turning them into slaves, building a couple of cities up in that area. Were they just bad people and deserved it? Did they deserve it? What did they do to deserve that? They were just living there and multiplying. Okay? Pharaoh was scared, okay? The Egyptian dynasties, the Egyptian government, they were scared of that great population growth, and they started to do things, either to start them off with labor, hard labor, maybe that would deal with them, and diminish the population growth. Apparently it didn't. Then they dealt with the idea of trying to deal with the birth of males. And then after the birth of males didn't work, they tried to just deal with all of them. Okay, all males would die. And they did this for what primary reason that it stated? Why they want no males? They were afraid rebellion. They were afraid all these people, which was quite strong, virile people, might side with other enemies that they have. Of course, in the world's timetable, there's always enemies. There's always one that will take over the property you have, especially if it's good property. And so that occurred. So then we've got within that situation where they're dealing with babies dying. Well, Moses was put by his mother into a reed basket, and the princess in the dynasty, okay, Pharaoh's daughter picked up Moses, raised him with the assistance and cooperation and that sort of thing of his mother. So we've got here now, 40 years old. We've got him going out to see his brethren now, and because he's got the idea from his mother, the education he's had, you know what? He's a Hebrew. He's a Hebrew, not an Egyptian. He's trained in all the Egyptian things, looks like a Hebrew, all that sort of thing. But he wants to meet his brother. So there's some ruckus going on, and he kills one of the Egyptians. And that's where we're at. Killed one of the Egyptians. And as he killed that Egyptian, waiting for, because he's heard the prophecies about coming to Egypt and going to the promised land, land of milk and honey, and maybe he wants to be their deliverer. He's going to start with a death. So that's where he's at. So now, in verse 2:15, when the Pharaoh heard of this matter, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the presence of the Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. So these next few verses, really the remaining part of the chapter, 2:15 forward, is he's fled Egypt, fugitive, and he needs somewhere to live. So he goes to Midian, which really isn't a Jewish area, okay? It's a mixed kind of religion, mixed race, that sort of thing. And he goes there and he sees some women. He helps them out, okay? And then he gets invited where? To their father's house of these seven girls, okay? And he's got a good reception there, a good reception. Yes, boy, before that, he was just sitting by the well. What am I going to do out here? All of a sudden, by providence of God, okay, and his actions, and we'll deal with character things, but his good actions toward them, he's invited into a household. He's invited into a family. He's invited into something stable, and they have food. And he's welcomed there, and over time, Jethro, who's a priest in Midian, and gives one of his daughters to him for marriage, and then he has a couple of sons. And so that's what he does for this next 40 years. He's there in the wilderness as a shepherd, and he's learning things, isn't he? Okay? Much different from the contrast. If you want to contrast things, look at what he was doing in Egypt, in the Pharaoh's house, son of the Pharaoh's daughter, all those privileges. Food was no problem. Didn't have to shepherd things. Okay? All those things were his, but now he's out here, and he's settled in. He's settled in. Interesting. Okay? And for the next 40 years, that's what he's doing. Being a priest, Midian, that sort of thing, and there's some good influence around. Apparently they have some goodness attached with them because he asked his daughter to go back and get him and come back and thank him and that sort of thing. And he had also expressed some, because the women were in some jeopardy with their flock, but he ran those men off, okay? So he's still got them little tendencies, you know, to I'm not going to say violence, but the idea of not being afraid of other men. And then they came to the house. So in verse 2:19, so they said, an Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds, and what is more, he even drew the water for us and watered the flock. That's quite a guy. And he said to the daughters in 20, where is he then, and why is it that you have left the man behind? Invite him to have something to eat. Moses willing to dwell with the men, and he gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses. Well, that's a quick. I'm sure there was some time went by there before he gave his daughter to him for marriage. And what's interesting in this is he calls himself a shepherd. I know in the last class, Sally mentioned about that, and I want to look at Genesis 46:33 for just a second. How did the Egyptians view shepherds? How did they view people that tended cattle? With disdain, didn't they? All right. Let me just read a couple of interesting verses in 46:33 and 34. And it shall come about when Pharaoh calls you and says, what is your occupation? That you shall say, your servants have been keepers of livestock from our youth, even until now, both we and our fathers, that you may live in the land of Goshen. For every shepherd is loathsome to the Egyptians. A lot of theories on that, but that's all of a sudden he's Egyptian doing this sort of thing, and it's loathsome to the Egyptians. Whether you grew up with that idea or not, but the point is that's how it was viewed by them. There's a lot of speculation on that. But it probably, like I said, mentioned last time, Sally, which is here, not here tonight, tending a sick child, that it had to do with their religion. It had to do with their religion. And they worshipped, you know, thousands of different idols, and among those was cattle. And that's the interesting part, that here's someone who tends that sort of thing, and actually also has sacrifices in this land of Goshen. Jews, sacrifices, sacrificing animals. So this is, you know, sacrificing our gods, all right? It's interesting. I was doing a little research, but what country on the face of the globe now deals with cattle in a special way?
India,
don't they? And of 39 states, like they have, and the country's divided over there, six to eight of them, forbid the killing of cattle. Not to mention eating it, which is the most of the area. And they're making movements now to outlaw that for the whole country. So there's a sacredness to that, okay, and it's still alive and well today. And there's a lot of things involved with that. But still, it's something that existed then, back in, basically 1500 BC, which is when this was written. So it's something to consider. All right. Now, of course, she gave birth in 222, and Goshen, and because he was a sojourner in a foreign land, and 23. Now, it came about in the course of many days that the king of Egypt died. Well, what's that mean to Moses? He left Egypt because they were after him to kill him, because he killed an Egyptian. And, you know, you could have one person after you, but a pharaoh after you, that's a big deal. So he's got some relief now, doesn't he? He's a sense of relief, okay? He's not leaving, but he knows that here, and he's writing it down for us here. And the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage, back to in Egypt now. They're sighing, they're in bondage, they're crying out. And like I mentioned last time, the first of the class, this is the first time in these last three verses, you know, chapter 2, where the people living in Egypt who come in with, you know, Jacob and with Joseph, that they're actually seeing they need relief. They need help. They're crying out to the God, Jehovah God, who had made these promises and covenants with their fathers. So they actually need help. So that's where we're leaving here. And God saw, God took notice, that sort of thing. So there's concern by God. God heard them. So that's where we're at the end of chapter 2. Now, questions. The questions on chapters 1 and 2. What period of time is covered from the time of Joseph's death to basically it's Mount Sinai? Okay, and you can see that in Exodus 12, 40 and 41. And what it says is the sons of Egypt made that trek from that time frame there, 430 years. And if you calculate that time, which I can deal with, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, there's 7 verses that'll get you to the number. You add and subtracting and all that sort of thing. I'd be happy to give that to you if you want it. But it came out to 359 years. So from Joseph's death to the Exodus, roughly 360 years. And that's that time where they're persecuted. Time where they're persecuted, the time where they're in hard labor, and some of the things we just read. That's what all this time is encompassing. Okay? And again, building those cities and all the things, the great suffering they were under. Call it bondage, call it slavery. Okay? From prosperity to the whip and slavery. That's a transition in that great people. And again, they prospered. All right. So there may be 2 million by this point or more. Now, that was question 2. And we went over the other questions, if there's any to talk about. Number nine, what did Moses give up to be identified with Israel rather than Egypt? That's an interesting point there. You know, there's always plenty of information we can suppose, we can conjecture. But in Hebrews chapter 11, which I reference on your questions, 11:23, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's edict. 24, and by faith, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. That was the trouble he got into. And verse 25, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. So no doubt that he understood the sin, the idolatry, and all the things connected with that, as stated here in your New Testament, Hebrews 11. That's why he's considered a man of faith. A man of faith. So let's remember that. And let's see. And number 12, question number 12. This is something we can think about. What character traits do you see in Moses based on Exodus 2? In 2:11, what do you say? Or go ahead. Someone answer that if they want to. When he cared for those at Egyptian, what was his thoughts? Yeah, he figured this can be his part to be a deliverer. It's a part where he can end the suffering somehow, and that's why he killed that Egyptian. And his brothers, other Hebrews, didn't understand that. But that showed what? Compassion? Care? Did it show something, too, about heritage, ancestry? So he's picking that up, isn't he? Okay? All those sort of things dealing with ancestry and where he's from and probably where he's going if he's dealing with the deliverer. So, and what, now, let's see. What about character when he concealed the crime? Remember he buried the Egyptian? What kind of. Yeah. Can you hide things from God? Can you hide things from God? No. Well, I'll extend it, okay.
But it's interesting that here you have a person who's born Hebrew, but he's brought up as an Egyptian. He's taught everything about the Egyptians. You know, he's obviously been trained as a warrior, but that's what the Egyptians did. And, I mean, it's like going from a rich family over to a blue-collar worker, you know. And he has the advantage of being able to know about all the traditions and everything Egyptian, but at the same time, his mom had brought him up in the tradition of the Hebrews, so he knew about the Hebrews, so he knew from the Hebrews.
Right. What kind of character did he show when he moved into the land of Midian? Humble. But here's a neighbor, kind people apparently, people in need of help, ones that are women being, I'm not going to say oppressed, but pushed around, okay, by some guys, and he took some leadership on that, And when he's in this 40 years, he got married. What does that tell you about him? He's accepting responsibility other than himself, isn't he? Okay. Now he has two children too, two boys. So his character in this 4 years, he's getting associated with another man in the family, the father-in-law. Okay. Of course, the sisters were there, and one of them got married later on. Anyway, so he's learning some things in these wilderness for this next 40 years that deal with his character. Deal with different responsibilities than he had before. So he's picking up wisdom. He He's picking up maturity. He's settling in. Again, it was in the back of his mind, maybe I'm a fugitive, but he's still doing those things. He's not just hiding himself in a cave. He's picked up a new profession. He's now a shepherd, okay, and dealing with all that. Yeah, that's right, a stranger, a sojourner. That's right, named after that. So there's a lot of things that you can see in character development with him. Anything else? Of course, yes. Has God talked to him yet? Okay, that's about to change, isn't it? All right, so any other things on chapters 1 and 2 that discuss? Great. All right. On that next question, you can look at your map on that, and you can see Egypt, the Nile River, on page number 12. Just to get a feel sometimes, I'll learn how to spell Sinai one of these days. All right. And on the revised copy. All right. But those are things to learn about. And those individuals in number 13 had Levi there. Is the idea that when you see that he, Moses, and his brother Aaron are called Levites. Well, again, we talked about last time the idea that this is the priesthood. And especially Aaron is going to be the high priest. So that direct responsibilities that's going to grow out of their lineage, especially Aaron. And you see his father there, and you can look those up, and his Moses' mother and sister, okay? Sister was about how old, maybe, when sister put him in the Nile River? Maybe 12, 10, somewhere in there, okay? And his father-in-law, and then his wife, and then his son here. Again, these are just names mentioned in this first couple of chapters, Gershon. Okay. Now, of course, his other son was Eleazar. Okay? So remember him. All right. Now, chapters 3 and 4. And I encourage everyone to read ahead. Maybe good to print out the verses and put them in your book. Okay? Or you can write on it as we go through. Now, so we start off in 3 and 4, and maybe while you got yours open, in question number 2, it is Exodus 3:4. That's Exodus 3:6. All right. I write that in. And on question number 10, you can reference the verse 4:14 on that. Question number 10, the reference verse is 4:14. All right. Exodus 3:1. Now Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Well, Horeb, when you see Horeb, you think Sinai. Reading on it, it looks like there may be two peaks or multiple peaks, and Horeb may be one and Sinai is another, but the point is they're together. Okay, that's the point. All right? So he's just having a normal day, isn't he? Normal day, an ordinary day, tending the flock, and something's going to happen. 3:2. The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire in the midst of the bush, and he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, yet the bush was not consumed. So Moses said, I must turn aside now and see this marvelous light while the bush is not burned up. And make me turn aside, okay, and check. And notice, too, that the blaze is not the bush. It's in the center of the bush, in the midst of the bush. Interesting. Now, just as a side note, and not burned up, verse 4. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush, and said, Moses, once? Moses twice. Okay? This is an interesting couple of words. Just get his attention. Make sure there's no mistake. I know who you are. No confusion here. No wind blowing that sounded like the word Moses. This is Moses. Okay? He's being talked to from the center of this, the flame in the center of the bush. And he says, here I am. 3:5. Then he said, do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place in which you're standing is holy ground. For some reason, and I can see it, that God views holy ground, take your sandals off, take that sort of thing off, because you stand on holy ground, special ground. You're in the presence of God. And apparently it shows respect and honor and reverence. And those things, this is different. It's different. Not making a direct comparison. But if you pray and you put your hands together, does that make your words different? Does it add a certain solemnness to it? A reverence to it? A direction? Just a thought. Just a thought. Okay? And let's see. Verse 3:6. And he said also, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Then Moses hid his face and he was afraid. What's the point of saying that? Why bring in the idea of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob? All the way back to Genesis 12, isn't it? And all the, again, there's multiple times he's brought this up. I'm that God. I'm that Jehovah. I'm that Lord, capital L-O-R-D, who made that promise to Abraham, to Isaac, Jacob, that my people will end up in a land of milk and honey. They'll end up in the promised land. Through them, the great blessings of Christ will come. So the land promise, and eventually the Messiah, that Messianic promise. All right. Now, and what about this God in 3:7? The Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have given heed to their cry. Here's cry again. Because of their taskmasters, for I'm aware of their sufferings. Great suffering going on. 3:8. So I have come down to deliver them. That's some of our words about going out, isn't it? Deliver them. The deliverer. See? Which is what Moses would be, wouldn't he? Okay. In a sense, Christ would be a deliverer too, wouldn't he? Sin. Bondage of sin into the promised land. And deliver them from what? The power of the Egyptians. Now, and bring them up from that land to a good and spacious land, to a land of milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite. Okay? Oh, those are all people living in that land of Canaan and around that Canaan and have to travel to that land of Canaan. All right. See. Anything else I want to say here? All right, 3:9. Now behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them. A restatement of what you just said. And that oppression, that slavery, that bondage caused the cry. After all these many years living under that, finally, they're crying out. They just can't take it anymore. Too much oppression. 3:10. Therefore, come now, and I will send you to Pharaoh, so that you may bring my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. Bring them out. Exodus. Exodus. So it's always been prophesied. It's always been promised in part of the covenant. Come out. Come out. All right. Out of Egypt. Now, beginning in 3:11, there's an interesting four points here that I want to bring up. And before we look at these four reasons why he wants Moses to lead them, you lead us, Moses. You're going to lead this. God wants you to. But, well, Moses said, well, I've got some problems with some of this. All right? I've got some things that you need to clarify for me. Remember, what's he talking to? talking to a bush, isn't he? With a flame in it. That's talking to him. Interesting. All right?
But it wouldn't burn it up.
Wouldn't burn it up either. Oh, it's certainly a miracle, isn't it? You know, Mark 16:20, you know, miracles confirm the word, don't they? All right? Something to think about. Now, so, before we look at these points, these four points coming up, I want to make two points, before we see what his demands were and his thoughts were and that sort of thing. One of them was Moses from privilege. Moses was from dynasties. He could have been a pharaoh once, who knows, okay? He was from all that. And here's God wants him to lead a people. So, does he want the riches back? You'll see in the next 4 points. Does he want the riches back? Does he want the power back that Egyptians had? Does he want all those things of privilege? No, it's not any part of the things he's thinking about. Okay? Now, the second point is, and this is something for us to remember too, that of all these excuses that he gives why he can't go back to Egypt and be this deliverer, and we understand it, we must understand it, God's always, always, always left the option open. You can say no. God's not going to override your will. Never, ever. Now, God works to do what to people, though? Persuade with words. Persuade with words. And when he persuades with those words or examples, okay, then he can also persuade with events, signs, wonders, miracles, providence. So God's not going to override your will, but he's certainly going to influence one way or another. And that's, you'll see some of the points, the 4 points we go through, to deal with the objections, the issues that Moses said, not me, all right? Remember, Moses always had the option of saying, no, none of this. Okay, I'm going back to Midian. I'm going to stay in Midian. Now, the first one, beginning in verse 11 and going through 12. He just told him, Therefore, come now, and I will send you to Pharaoh so that you may bring my people, sons of Israel, sons of Jacob, out of Egypt. 3:11. But, there's always a but in there. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? And he said, certainly I will be with you, and this shall be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain, Horeb, Sinai. Now, who am I? Who am I? I don't have the stature to do this. I've shown in the past that I've run away. Besides, I'm an Egyptian. And you want me to lead people? You want me to reach back and be part of the fulfillment of the great promises, the great covenant? Interesting, isn't it? Okay? But God said, I will be with you in 3:12. And to show you that, you know, in some time from now, okay, when we get to the mountain, of course, that's kind of looking ahead, isn't it? Okay, that's really looking ahead. And I don't know if you can see that far. So he had objections on that point. So, sometimes we may say, who am I? Who am I to be a part of this? Who am I to be and lead in a certain situation? Who am I to discipline a house and a household? Who am I to whatever, okay? So it's things to think about. That's his first objection. Any points on that? Any questions? Okay. Now, in 13 through 22, a long section here for the next objection. And let me say ahead of time on this one that when we look at this, and this second one, there's going to be a challenge going on. When we get challenged on certain things, or I don't have all the answers. Don't have all the answers. Now in 13, then Moses said to God, "Behold, I am going to the sons of Israel, and I will say to them, the God of your father has sent me to you. Now they may say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them?" Oh, so they're going to ask me questions. They're going to ask me questions. Who sent you? You want us to do what? You want us to pack up everything and leave and maybe fight Egypt or who knows what? Okay? 2 million of us who are, I know we're in slavery, but you want 2 million of us to leave and go out in where? Not to another land that's right around the corner that's got plenty of food, cattle, and grazing area, and houses. No, not to the wilderness. You want that? And what's his name? Who is he going to be? So in 3:14, God said to Moses, "I am who I am." And he said, "Thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, I am has sent me to you." I've got a lot of words here dealing with the I am. We talked a little bit last time about in these idols that Egypt had and really the world had, they got to have a name for each one. They all got to have a name. But the name that God gives is an I am. I am who I am. So there is no real name. And what's interesting about that, there's some other words that we can use, and you've heard these. Self-existence. Not depending on anything, anybody, anything. Self-existence, God. Okay? An omni-God. Eternal God. One who has complete control. And this is opposed to what? Idols. You'll really notice when we deal with Egypt, deal with the Exodus, everything has that inclination or even a direct objective to deal and counter thoughts, counter everything that's idols, anything that would assume to be a god, one who has those sort of powers. And that's really what's going on with all this, to convince people by the plagues, to convince them by the care in the wilderness as he leads them, convince the 600 chariots and their men that when they die in the Red Sea, convince the countries and areas around them that those idols are useless, false, and the Lord God is the God of creation, the God of the universe, the God of time, the God of eternity, the God who is with these chosen people, and the God that exists today. Okay, you and I worship. Now, Three 15. God furthermore said to Moses, "Thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, the Lord, capital L-R-D, the God of your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever. This is my memorial name to all generations." Okay? All generations. All time. This is who I am. I'm not going to change. I am, again, self-existent, majestic, eternal. All those sort of things that you can depend on, you can trust. Again, he sends prophets, doesn't he? Okay, prophets to inform. And of course, the great prophet, the great Christ, okay, came in our New Testament times. Now, 3:16, go and gather the elder of Israel together and say to them, "The Lord, the God of your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, appeared to me, saying, I am indeed concerned about you and what has been done to you in Egypt." Concerned. After all these years, man, there's been hundreds, you know, hundreds of years where they've been in this slavery, this problem of suppression, this idea of a hard labor. Finally, it looks like the time has come. Time has come for fulfillment. Okay? Moses missed it by 40 years. But now it's coming. It's coming. Okay? And 17, so I said, "I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt, land of the Canaanites, Amorite, Perizzite, Jebusite, milk and honey. and they will pay heed to what I say, and you with the elders of Israel will come to the king of Egypt, and you will say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, once you cross the river, has met with us. So now, please let us go for 3 days during the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord your God. At 3:19 is an interesting part. Oh, okay, we'll just go talk to him. But I know that the king of Egypt will not permit you to go except under compulsion. Compulsion. Okay? And when you look at that in your margins, compulsion is a strong hand, a mighty hand. So it's going to take some strength. It's going to take the exertion of the great power of God to deal in the situation that's going to be coming up. So that's what's coming now. In the last few verses, I'll summarize it, a few verses real quick. I sent you. I am indeed concerned. I'll bring you up. I have seen. I have come down. I am aware of your sufferings. All those sort of things God is aware of. And that should concern us today and be a part of our psyche today, that God is aware of everything. Thoughts, actions, concerns, future, past, all those sort of things. And God is concerned. Things are done on His timetable. His timetable. Okay? Now, so he knows the king of Egypt is going to be not agreeable to letting the people go, letting them travel to this land of Canaan. So in Exodus 3:20, so, okay, he's not going to let you go. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my miracles, which I shall do in the midst of it, and after that he will let you go. That sums it up. That sums up the exit. Exodus, all right? It's going to be difficult, but I'm going to be with you. I will stretch out my hand, which goes along with mighty hand and strong hand, the word compulsion, and let you go. Let you go. Okay, 3:21. I will grant this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and it shall be that when you shall not go empty-handed. And it goes on, let me read this part. But every woman shall ask of her neighbor, and the woman who lives in her house, articles of silver and gold, clothing. You will put them on your sons and daughters, thus you will plunder the Egyptians. When he asks them to go out, God's thinking about the things that are going to be on their mind. Am I going to have supplies? Am I going to have food? Am I going to have clothing? And again, additionally to that, gold and silver and those sort of things, which we see later on, is not to buy things, but to use in the tabernacle. See, when they get to Mount Sinai and they construct all that. Yes, sir. Great commandments. All right, we'll have to stop here. And let's see. Stop here. All right, we continue.